you know, for any of you Google hackers there, I'm sure this guy went through and totally milked all of this. And you should definitely not look for any of the ones that he missed using AppScript. And you should also definitely not diff the AppScript docs to make sure when new functions are added that you can't be abused to do something similar. I think that's probably a waste of time because this guy definitely found everything, as all testers do. Sup, hackers. So Zero Trust World just happened and ThreatLocker dropped some pretty cool stuff. My favorite of the bunch was ThreatLocker Cloud Control, and I'll tell you why, okay? So when you're trying to hack an organization nowadays, what's kind of like the go-to approach? Well, for most, it's going to be set up Evil Nginx and send out a bunch of phishing emails, right? That way you don't have to worry about two-factor authentication or anything like that, because Evil Nginx is just going to let them put in their password, their 2FA, and then just hand you back a session token to interact with Microsoft 365. So ThreatLocker realized this was a problem, and so what they decided to do was build Cloud Control, which uses the ThreatLocker agent to sync into Microsoft Cloud Conditional Access a list of approved IP addresses from which a user can connect, right? So then an attacker gets that token that they stole by Evil Nginx. They try to use it to interact with Microsoft 365, and boom, they're burned because they're not coming from a permitted network, and they lose access. It's pretty sick. It's a great solution to the problem. So definitely check it out, ThreatLocker Cloud Control. All right, back to the show. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, hackers, this kind of week is the week that makes the podcaster, let me tell you. Our boy Rezo is out sick, and I have been in a wedding all weekend as one of our close friends was getting married, and we are the primarily responsible party. And it is now 2:30 on a Sunday when this podcast was due on a Thursday, and I'm still showing up for you guys. Hopefully that shows how much I love you guys. So we're just going to do a quick little solo episode this week. We're going to run through some research and we're going to call it a week, but I had to give you guys something to listen to, right? You know, I can't disappoint my listeners. And shout out to the production team for dealing with my late, missing the deadlines. Thanks, Richard. Thanks, Christian. Appreciate you guys. All right. So let's get into the research. This week, we're going to cover four pieces of research. We're going to cover, PortSwigger's SAML roulette that they just released. We're going to cover three Google reports that just got disclosed with some cool attack vectors in them. And then finally, we're going to wrap it up with this Next.js corrupt middleware research that just dropped a couple days ago, which is like crazy. All right, let me get some water. Let's jump into it. All right, so first up, let's look at SAML roulette. This is, once again, an awesome piece of research that was released by the PortSwigger research team, Gareth, and one of the other researchers who's listed around here somewhere. Where is he? Zach. Yep. And this was unfortunately a research collision with Alexander Tan, a HackerOne who I've mentioned several times on the podcast, who's kind of like the SAML god. I've reached out to them and said, hey, could you like come on the pod? And they said, sure. Let me just get some CVEs disclosed. So if you're listening to this, Alexander, now's your time, man. Come on, let's go. Let's get on the pot. But I'm definitely going to ping him after this one because it's pretty sick. Let's kind of go through this specific attack. This was a SAML bypass completely in Ruby SAML affecting GitLab, unauthenticated account takeover. And it was pretty awesome. So this type of attack comes from a technique called round trip attacks. And I'll read this one line from the write up here, which describes it pretty well. SAML libraries often parse an XML document, store it as a string, and then later reparse it. In Ruby SAML, this process involves two different parsers: re-XML, which is used to parse the document and validate the signature, and nokogiri, which is used to access attributes. And that should be sending alarm bells off in your head, right? Because anytime there's sort of like this double parsing environment, then there's a chance that there will be discrepancies. And that's exactly what the PortSwigger research team manipulated in the specific environment. So how did they do that exactly? Well, they came up with this excellent payload, which is being shared on the screen for any of you who are following along on YouTube. But this is a podcast, so I will also say it out loud. Essentially, what's happening here is they present a XML document that has a single quoted attribute in it. And this attribute contains an XML comment and some entities inside of it. And essentially what happens then is when this document is parsed the first time, the single quoted attribute will be parsed as an attribute. But then when it's put, you know, stored as a string, like we said in the first part, that single quoted attribute becomes a double quoted attribute. Well, that's a problem because the first attribute had a double quote in it. So that would close the double quoted attribute that was being converted from the single quote and then allow you to specify various other tags and comments and stuff like that. So what they did here is they specified a comment and were able to insert a malicious assertion into this YAML response, which then gets picked up by the auth engine later and used to determine which user should be logged in. So essentially what they're doing here is they're using attribute manipulation. They're using a double quote or a single quoted attribute. And then when it's converted into a double quote attribute, it does something different to the XML document. Very cool stuff there. And it definitely makes sense that that would be happening when there's two different parsing engines being used to affect the XML there. So that's kind of the TLDR of the first part. You can read more thoroughly on the actual write-up if you'd like. But the idea was double parse the XML document and then have a, you know, some data that is in a attribute in the first time around that is not in an attribute the second time around, allowing us to insert some malicious XML. But the attack gets a little bit more difficult than that because of a couple factors. One, you know, they kind of want arbitrary unauthenticated account takeover, right? But the way that this works is they need to provide a valid signature for them to go through the first signature check XML document parsing, right? So they said, you know, in the beginning, let me see if I can find that quote. They said that this process involves two different parsers, re-XML, which is used to parse the document and validate the signature, and NoCoGiri, which is used to access attributes, okay? So in order to get past that first one, the re-XML, they have to provide a valid signature to their SAML response endpoint, right? And one of the ways that they did that was super cool, is that they used this metadata endpoint that was associated with the XML environment. Let me see if I can pull it up here. Yes, right here. It says, finding a valid signed XML document can be challenging. Fortunately, the identity providers silently provide a single sign-on protocol, WS Federation, by default for every tenant. WS Federation provides signed metadata XML endpoints such as this, and they link to an XML endpoint. So essentially what they're able to do is hit this metadata endpoint that is signed. And then because that has a valid signature on it, they can reuse that signature to bypass that first part and then utilize the attribute discrepancies to insert their own assertion into the XML document on the second parse through. So very creative attack vectors here. The other piece that I kind of wanted to mention on this one that I kind of skipped over for a second was how exactly they got it to look at their assertion versus the assertion that was originally provided in the document. And the way that they did that was by using something that I had never seen before in XML. Let me see if I can find it here in the document. Yeah, here it is right here, which is a, you know, we all know about entities being defined in doctype, right? That's how you do traditional XML entity attacks. But what I hadn't known is that you can specify other types of objects as well inside the doctype. You can specify attributes, entities, and elements, right? So those three, elements, attributes, entities. And if you think about it, that's kind of what makes up an XML document. Or if you even think about it from HTML, which is sort of a tweak of XML, you know, you've got your elements, you've got your tags, right? You've got the attributes for those tags. And then you've got these entities, right? You know, your dollar sign or your ampersand sign, and then the entity and then the semicolon, right? So it's cool that you can define all three of those inside of the doctype. And it just, when I was thinking about this and when I was researching it, it kind of made me realize a little bit more, wow, okay, I kind of feel like I have a better grip on XML now that I know what this doctype is used for and it's being used to define these various elements. So what they ended up doing here was they looked at the way that NoCoGiri was checking for the signature piece. I'm sorry, not NoCoGiri. This is the one that is REXML. Searches for the signature element. And the way that it does that is that it does a XPath selector on a specific attribute. So it looks for a DS signature, and it looks for the DS attribute to point to XML dsig. So then what they did is they changed what assertion would have that using that uncommented out attribute, right? So then when the attribute went from single quote to double quote, they applied a doc type ATT list, which is as opposed to a doc type entity. They used the bang ATT list to define a specific value for the XML NS attribute on the signature block, which allowed them to sort of hijack which of the assertions or which signature, it should be looked at different times in the document. So really, really creative technique here to take advantage of the fact that they have the ability to modify the XML document essentially after it's being parsed using document types. They use that to insert an attribute to a specific signature that they wanted, which was a really, really creative technique. And so I kind of went down the rabbit hole a little bit when I was researching this and reading through it. And, you know, I figured out that there was elements, attributes, and entities, but then I also found this really, really weird image. And Christian, I've got it in the doc, so just go ahead and put that up on the screen, the use of elements versus attributes. There's this picture that I took from the docs that says, apparently data can be stored in a child element or in an attribute. So if you have something like, the example that they gave here was, they have a person tag in XML, right? And they have sex equals female. And then they've got, you know, additional data about that person, such as their first name and last name in the XML document, and they close off the person tag, right? So the sex for the person is defined in the attribute. And then they said, this is an equivalent document. And they say person, close the tag. And then inside that, there's another tag that has sex, that has first name, that has last name, and then you close the person tag. And apparently you can use attributes and sub-elements interchangeably in XML, which I was like, what? That seems super whack. Anytime you have an attribute on a tag, you can also specify that attribute as a subtag of the tag that the attribute should have been on, which seems a little bit weird to me. And I'm sure there's weird shit out there that takes advantage of that fact. So definitely check that out if you're interested in XML or XML confusions, that sort of thing. All right, let me take a look at my notes really quick here and make sure I didn't forget about anything else. Yeah, I mean, I would just say everybody who is interested in XML, you should take a look at how doc types work. I just read the W3 Schools sort of write-ups on how they work, and there's some really interesting stuff in there that isn't sort of surface level what you would think about when you think about doc types. So I definitely recommend that. All right, solo episode, guys. So I don't get the chance to take a breather while Joseph's talking, and I got to get my water real quick before we move on to the next one. All right, so this next write-up that I kind of wanted to cover with you guys, let me give a little bit of context to this. So the Google VRP does have disclosed reports, but they don't get disclosed very often. And recently, they just kind of did a batch release of some of the reports from 2024. So I kind of went through and skimmed through each one of them and tried to find the ones that had the coolest attack vectors to it. And I'll go ahead and kind of go through those now with you guys. And just kind of give you the TLDR on what you could take away from those. So this one right here is entitled Loophole of Getting Google Form Associated with Google Sheets with No Editor/Owner Access. So essentially, this is a way for you to take the Google Sheet that is associated with a specific Google Form, right, where it stores the results from the Google Form, and get that original URL for the form so you can make more submissions. And I just thought that this was such an excellent example of understanding how your target's security model and your threat model works, right? Because I think if you're not intimately familiar with Google Drive and what you should or what you should not be able to see, then you wouldn't know that you're not supposed to be able to get the form associated with a given spreadsheet that contains the results of that form. So the researcher here dove really deep, understood the threat model really well, and was rewarded with a $7,500 bounty for this finding. Essentially what he did was he took the document ID from the resulting spreadsheet, and he created another spreadsheet and added an app script to that. Excuse me, my voice is getting a little raspy. he took the document ID and put it inside of a app script function in a spreadsheet that he does own and have editor access on, and used the spreadsheet app.openById function to open up the ID of the spreadsheet that he had read access on, but not owner and edit, and called the get form URL function on that specific spreadsheet. And that returned the form that the user was not supposed to have access to. So I just thought that this was such an awesome attack vector scenario, right? Using this app script language and the functions in that language to test and validate that they're implementing the threat model surrounding who should have access to what properties of a Google Sheet correctly. And I just thought that was awesome. And so he did that once here and got $7,500 for it. And then he did it one more time over here. So it was December 2024, and he got $15,000 for this one, which is nuts. And this one is very similar, just does the exact same flow, grabs the document ID from the read-only document, and then passes it into an app script on a document that he does own, and calls the get editors function to get a list of people who have edit rights to the specific document. And apparently, if you have read-only right to a document, you shouldn't be able to see the email addresses and users' information of the other editors on the doc. So this one actually dumped back emails and stuff like that, usernames, which Google considers pretty valuable information. And so this was a really awesome find. I love that model. And, you know, for any of you Google hackers there, I'm sure this guy went through and totally milked all of this. And you should definitely not look for any of the ones that he missed using AppScript. And you should also definitely not diff the app script docs to make sure when new functions are added that you can't be abused to do something similar. I think that's probably a waste of time because this guy definitely found everything, as all testers do. All right, let's go ahead and move to the next one. Ooh, a little bit of water popped out there and got on my glasses. All right, let's go to the next one. Let's see, right here. Okay, this was another write-up that actually only got $500, which I was a little bit disappointed on, but I kind of wanted to talk on it because it was relevant to a sort of topic I wanted to discuss with you all. So let me first dive into it and then tell you what's happening. So the title for this one is Cloud Tools for Eclipse, Chaining Misconfigured OAuth Callback Redirection with Open Redirect Vulnerability to Leak Google OAuth Token with Full GCP Permissions, which one sounds sick. So Mr. Mo Sucker that reported this, you rock. but essentially, the TLDR of this one is with Google OAuth in this specific environment, you could redirect to a local host, essentially, which is something that we often see in OAuth flows, either like a default URI that is approved is any port on localhost. Or, you know, specific client IDs have starred localhost in, on any port, you know, opened up as available for a redirect URI. And what this guy did is he actually went and found a product from Google that listens on port, on this port that was allowed, port 8080, and then found an open redirect in that product and chained it together, right? So they can't say like, oh, well, if you have localhost, you know, access to catch the callback, then you already have the device owned or whatever. Right, they have to take responsibility for their own tool that had an open redirect on that specific URL and port, and then sort of chain that all the way through. So I thought that was brilliantly done by the researcher here, and it also made me think of another attack vector that sort of was recently came to my attention with regards to localhost redirects for OAuth callbacks, and that is that when you are on a mobile device. Any app on that device can listen to any port above 1024 without any additional permissions, right? So you can just have an Android mobile app that just binds to port 8080 and then gets a callback from these specific OAuth callbacks that allow access to port 8080 or localhost, whatever port, right? And so I had a friend recently that pocked that out and submitted it to a program, and it got informative because you have an app on the device, which is just so dumb. And I'm not going to name and shame the program. I'm going to give them some time to like do their thing. But yeah, I was pretty disappointed by that outcome because you cannot just let every other app on the device have access to your account, right? Like, that's not okay. So I think that this is a very valid attack vector. And I think that it was really easy, surprisingly easy with Cursor and such to pock that script that creates the mobile app and catches the OAuth code. So definitely something you guys want to be on the lookout for. All right, so that was all I had for the Google write-ups. Definitely some cool ones there. There are some other good ones there. I just didn't decide. They just weren't as like broadly applicable to everybody. So I grabbed those three just because I thought they were like, this is a really cool way to approach a target for the first one. And then, you know, obviously the callback to localhost stuff is just really applicable to so many programs. All right, last one, guys, and then I'm going to go chill. It is Sunday, so I normally try to take Sunday pretty chill, but this week was crazy with the wedding. So, all right, this next piece of research is by Zero WebSec, Zero with an H, Z-H-E-R-O. Maybe it's Z-Hero. I don't know, kind of a cool name. But they also did some research. Before I jump into this one, the Next.js and the Corrupt middleware, they also did some other research earlier this year that released in January on web cache stuff for Next.js, which actually I don't see in their, oh, it's under their research tab on their website. Yeah, right here. So they've been kind of poning JavaScript-based frameworks for a little while. This is the one I was thinking of right here, Next.js, Cache and Chains, the Stale Elixir. So there's lots of good research here if you're interested in Nuxt or Next.js. So definitely go check that out. But this one in particular I thought was hilarious because the payload is so simple. So the researcher kind of went through the Next.js source code and was looking at middleware. And apparently deep within the code of the Next.js middleware, there is this blob of code that checks the x-middleware-subrequest header. And if this header contains a specific string, then it will just skip all the middleware. Lovely, right? And the reason that they created this was, as the researcher noted in the write-up, so that there isn't like an infinite loop of middleware, right? If the middleware sends a request to another, you know, route on the application, then it's not just going to infinitely loop on the middleware. So that's cool. I like that. But the way that they implemented it was so funny. It was like, okay, X middleware sub request, and then the value for it is like the path of the where the middleware lives, which is like extremely predictable in this Next.js environment, because at the time of there was only like one router that exists, the pages router, and your middleware had to be placed underneath that in underscore middleware. So this payload right here, X middleware dash sub request, with the value of pages slash underscore middleware was all you needed to bypass any middleware, which is often, very often, where authentication or authorization checks are being done. So that was a great find by the researcher here. And that this specific exploit affects versions before 12.2. But there, after 12.2, there's a different exploit that is required because of the middleware code getting moved around, which is this one. With that in mind, the payload for the first version starting with version 12.2 is very simple, x-middleware-subrequest:middleware, right? Just super easy to tack on there. And then there's another variant where it could be in the sources directory, so source/middleware. Really awesome stuff that they have here. They built out all of the different paths. There are a couple edge cases as well where you might need to repeat your payload across different versions. But this, I feel like, is massively exploitable in a bug bounty environment. And they did go through and milk it on some bug bounty programs, as they said in the article. Obviously, the biggest impact would be, you know, auth bypass here, and you can access some routes that should be protected. But they also mentioned that oftentimes CSP headers are implemented in middleware, so you can use it to bypass CSP and get that version cached. Or you can do DOS via cache poisoning as well if there is sort of a rewrite that was happening in the middleware for various like location-based stuff. And so really, really great finds here, very thorough. And yeah, I think it's really applicable to bug bounty. I think any of you recon boys out there that can do mass scanning may want to sort of look for those 403 endpoints that are coming back from Next.js middleware, and then try to tack on like a few variants of the payloads that are in this write-up to try to bypass auth in those environments. So, all right, I think that's about all I had from the research for this week. Let me see if there's anything else. We do have a fun episode planned for next week when Rezo gets feeling back better. So I'll save most of the stuff that I had planned for that for the next time around. I guess as I'm closing out here, I will say, would love to see all of you guys in the Critical Thinking Discord. We've got a really awesome community over there, especially in the Critical Thinkers. We've got some fun masterclasses up. We've got some hackalongs scheduled. And then we've also got the Full-Time Hunters Guild for any of you guys who are doing this full-time. That's been particularly helpful for me. I've essentially said to Yuji, who's the community manager here at Critical Thinking, hey, I want you to run this, and I'm going to be a member of the Full-Time Hunters Guild because that's what I need. And so I've just kind of been chilling. You know, I'll pop in and do like the meet and greets and stuff like that. But I've mostly been using the Full-Time Hunters Guild as like an accountability thing for me, and collaborating with some of the other hackers there. And I can personally say it's been really helpful. So for any of you full-time hunters that are listening, I would love to see you in that. Definitely apply. You can find the application at ctbb.show/full-time-hunters-guild, FTHG, right? /FTHG for Full-Time Hunters Guild. All right, that's a wrap on this week. Love you guys. See you next week. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunters guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time, trust me. All right, I'll see you there.